Good evening, Jeannie. How are you?
I'm doing great. And how are you tonight? Actually, we are thrilled.
We are really thrilled.
We are in the presence of greatness tonight, ladies and gentlemen. We have the great and incomparable John Mayall sitting in this very room, in the BluePower.com room.
Absolutely. The father of British blues, ladies and gentlemen, on BluePower.com.
And we have them all to ourselves for the next 70 minutes, and we are going to relish it and take full advantage of it and ask him all kinds of questions.
How are you, John?
Well, it's fine. The Internet is a wonderful thing.
It sure is. Isn't it wonderful?
All right. Anytime you're ready, Jeannie.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to an evening with John Mayall.
Bernard Jenkins, John Mayall on the Blues Breakers. John, Who's playing? Who are the band members?
Well, there's no Blues Breakers on it, actually. It's it was recorded by Eric Clapton and I, in an interim period when Decca wasn't too pleased with our live album, John Mayall Plays John Mayall Live at Klook's Clique, and they kind of dropped us, and so we were out of work temporarily. But Mike Vernon, at that particular time, had his own little record label called Purdar Records, and it was his idea to grab Eric and I and do a couple of sides on his label, and that was one of them. So it was just a duet, and on the other side, I played harmonica and he played guitar. So very informal. We never realized that it would go as far as it got.
Listen, was that before the Blues Breakers?
Yeah, it was before. It was, like I say, once Mike had released that single, then he managed to talk Decca Records into giving us another chance, because by then, with Eric in the Blues Breakers, we'd enlarged our fan base considerably.
Yeah.
The rest is history, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The Blues Breakers were originally, the original Blues Breakers were...
Well, there was a bunch of people. I mean, for the first year when I was semi-professional, London was a strange city for me, and of course it took me a while to kind of settle on a regular lineup. But initially, for the first year, we'll say Bernie Watson was the guitar player, and Huey Flint was the drummer who came with me from Manchester, and John McVie was the bass player, and he and Huey, you know,
yeah,
carried on into the next chapter.
Excellent. Always made great music. You were in the army for 3 years, huh?
Yeah, yeah, like a fool, I signed up. Yeah.
Was that an automatic thing that you had
well,
to do there?
Well, you had to do national service once you became 18. But there was a very smooth talking recruiting officer who made it seem like I'd be an absolute fool to sign on for 2 years, when if for an extra year I could get more pay. And of course, it's only after you've signed on the dotted line you realize, oh, I've got an extra year to do with this.
Uh-huh.
Hell.
Oh my God!
So. Did they station you in any choice prime places?
Yeah, Korea.
Korea.
Korea,
yeah.
Really?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Now, meanwhile, of
it's
course,
nice,
you traveled with, yeah, with some kind of... Yeah, but I'm sure you traveled with some kind of instrument during...
Yeah,
I took a guitar.
Uh-huh. I took a guitar, and I also played piano on the ship going over, but basically you couldn't carry a piano around.
No.
In the sense of career, the guitar was the only thing I could
play. They're
hard
to run with, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
You're also in the Manchester College of Art.
Yeah, I did that after I came back from Korea.
Mm-hmm. Do you paint, or...?
Well, I did a bit of everything, but I eventually specialized in graphic design and typography. And, of course, that came in useful after I came into the music business at the age of 30, because then I was able to design my own record covers and, you know.
You got into the music business at the age of 30?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Well, you know, I'd always played blues music right from, you know, being like 13 years old, but, of course... people would turn away in horror, not knowing what the hell it was all about. Of course. So there was no market for it, and I never ever considered that I could earn a living from it. So, you know, it was only after Alexis Korner kind of kicked the thing off in London that I realized that there was an audience now for it. So I came down to London and put the first Blues Breakers together with the help of Alexis Korner, who turned me on to a few musicians and club owners, and that's how it all began.
So what did you do between college? I'm sorry, John.
Sorry, go ahead.
Between college and the 30-year-old decision to change careers
well,
and go full-time for
yeah,
music?
After I graduated from college, then I went into studio side, the art department of advertising agencies, and I got worked up to be a studio manager in one of the firms in Manchester. And then for the first year, when I was semi-professional in London, then I held the same position at an advertising firm in London.
The blues scene then in London must have been pretty good.
It was incredibly exciting. Like I say, it was the music that I'd always played all my life and been familiar with, and now, of course, it was being accepted with open arms by... A new generation of people, and it was a very exciting time to come into the thing.
Were there a lot of black American black blues players over there at that time?
No, none at all.
None at all. They weren't playing.
You know, the black blues players, all our legends and heroes, they would come over periodically from the mid 50s as part of German folk blues festivals that would be a package where you'd get to see these people.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was a great event to be actually see these people in person.
Mm-hmm.
And then after those kind of got established and the blues scene got established, then John Lee Hooker came over to do a club tour, and you know, we were the first band to work with an American blues man on a club tour, and mm-hmm. it was pretty amazing the success that enjoyed, and it led to us working with Sonny Boy Williamson, who did a lot more work with the Yardbirds than he did with us. And that was when Clapton was in the band there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, you know, T-Bone Walker came over and we backed him, and it sort of mushroomed from there.
Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty thriving blues scene, but mostly white musicians.
Yeah, Rolling Stones, yeah. Georgie Fame, The Animals, Stevie Winwood, Spencer Davis, you know, the list is quite extensive.
It says that John Mayall is a gifted band leader who demanded total dedication to his music.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't think of it in terms of demanding. It, you know, I think the better thing is that a good band leader provides the right environment so that a musician can play himself and yet be a part of something where everybody understands what each other's playing and motives and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
He developed
it's a collective thing.
It is. It
yeah.
Is. But it does take somebody to be a good leader, and a good leader tends to bring the best out of everybody with a general focus direction. I've had an opportunity to work with some outstanding band leaders and also some people on the other end of the spectrum, and the difference between the two is mile wide.
Absolutely.
And greatly yeah. appreciated when you get to work with great band leaders, you know.
Yeah.
Well, let's put up another cut.
Okay, we'll move on. Of course, yeah. the focus is usually on Mayall's guitar players, especially mm-hmm. in that English period when it was all happening and Hendrix was over there and the Who, just everything was happening. And the next guitar player to come in and fill Eric's shoes after he left to form Cream with Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker was, of course, Peter Green. And so this is one of the singles that we did. It did find its way onto an LP called Looking Back, which was a collection of singles from the 60s. And this is one, a particular favorite of mine, called Picture on the Wall, which is more of an unplugged kind of thing. It was acoustic.
Let's check it out. John Mayall and Peter Green.
I was looking through my pictures of days that's been gone. Well, I was looking through my pictures of days that's been gone. When I saw a man and woman, you and me when we night and day together, blues made across the sea. We were night and day together, blues made across the sea. When I think of summer weather, see a picture of you. The sun's a ball of fire, couldn't even hold your hand. My day, the sun's a ball of fire, couldn't even hold your hand. But at night I'd hold your body, keep you warm in the cold, cold sand. It's a sad old recollection, super saw the picture fade. Yeah, it's a sad old recollection, super saw the picture fade. I upset you, left you crying, left you an eye for down the blade. Time I think of summer, see a picture on the wall. Every time I think of summer, see a picture on the wall. It will always be a reminder
Go for it, John.
Yeah, I didn't realize that until I heard it just now, that there is no bass player on that, and it's Keith Hartley with just brushes on the snare drum or something. Mm-hmm. But it was after Peter Green had left to form Fleetwood Mac and taken John McVie with him. And it was a single that I was doing where it was a continuation of that sort of blues alone thing where I was going to play, you know, a couple of instruments or whatever. But I played regular guitar, and I think that's the first time I heard Peter Green play acoustic slide guitar, so it's a nice combination.
Speaking of instruments, John, how many instruments do you play? I was noticing on the Blues Breaker album, the Padlock on the Blues, that you're playing, say I caught at least 4 or 5 12-string, you're playing bass, you're playing slide. How many do you play, and how many do you feel you play really proficiently?
Well, the keyboards have always been my main instrument, so you can count piano, and then there's organ on that one out on the new album also.
Mm-hmm.
I play slide guitar, 6-string slide guitar on one of the tracks that we have on the new album with the track with John Lee Hooker as our special guest, and the 12-string guitar on one of the tracks. So harmonica is the other main instrument. So I like to put a little bit of everything on, on an album if I get the opportunity.
That's amazing.
It says here that guitar, harmonica, keyboards, vocals, harmonium, harpsichord, organ.
Oh, you see, well, they're doubling up. They're all keyboards, you know, the organs.
What is a harmonium?
It's one with the pedals on, the foot pedals.
Ah.
You know, they have in churches and all that.
Oh, will you pedal away?
Puddle it, and it blows wind.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's on there because it's on one of the tracks on one of those albums, I think Bear Wires album from 68.
What was it like working with Peter Green?
Oh, it was great. I mean, he's one of the classic British blues guitar players of that era, and you know, anything that he did was just great. So he was in the band for a year before he put Fleetwood Mac together, and then of course when that took off, then I brought Mick Taylor into the picture, and of course that's the track we're going to hear next, which is a full-on version of more of a Blues Breakers sound. But this is when I expanded it to have 7 people in the band. Propelled by the wonderful drumming of John Heisman, and Tony Reeves is on bass. We have Dick Hexall Smith and Chris Mercer on saxophones, and of course I'm playing 6-string guitar on this one, and Mick is playing his inimitable guitar. So it's a roaring thing. We recorded this one at a university. I think it might have been Brighton or something like that, but it's a live version, and it really kicks.
All right.
Start walking.
All right.
That's it. Yeah. You weren't kidding, Don. You weren't kidding. I am so grateful that the tape was rolling during that performance.
Yeah.
Well, you guys must have been thrilled with yourselves when you heard that played back the next day.
Yeah, well, that came from one of my own tapes, because at that time I used to record every night on my little reel-to-reel thing, and so that came from one of my sessions.
Absolutely amazing.
So, yeah, the thing is that was pretty much the last lineup where I used a drummer, which, yeah. You know, the following year then I moved on to the drummerless thing, because after John Heisman on drums, I mean, he is...
Unbelievable.
He is England's acknowledged master of the drums. He's a jazz drummer.
Jesus.
And he's just...
He's great hands.
He's incredible.
Yeah.
He's the leader of Coliseum and has held that one together for the last couple of decades, so he's a great band leader too.
And that was Mick Taylor playing.
Yeah,
guitar.
Mick Taylor there, and I was on the rhythm guitar and
singing,
holding it all together.
Yeah,
there.
Absolutely.
Directing traffic.
Yeah, you know, I was talking today to a friend and telling him that we were going to interview you tonight,
mm-hmm.
and he said he kind of scratched his head and he looked over at me. He goes, "You know what? John Mayall was the CEO of the Blues." And I said, "You know what? You're probably right. The man was a master at surrounding himself with excellent players. And to do that, I mean, you got to know what you like."
Exactly. Well, that's the key to it, really. I think a band leader has that privilege of being able to indulge his own musical fantasies and whatever. And, you know, he's the one who hires people. So you really have an open palette to work with.
Let's talk a bit about the British record companies,
mm-hmm.
and how they were. I mean, I know how they were, the American ones were, but the British companies.
Well, my experience is fairly limited. Like I say, Decca was the Decca Records was the first company that I went with. Like I say, they got disenchanted when the first album only sold 500 copies in the first 6 months and only a little less than 500 in the next 6 months. But, of course, after the Blues Breakers with Clapton took off, it was a different story. So I did 10 albums with them, and basically I never really met anybody from the company. Mike Vernon was the producer in all cases, and he was the one who reported back to me was that they didn't understand a thing about it, but it seemed to be working, so they better keep out of the way.
You mean they never came out to...
No, they said, "I don't understand this, but it seems to be all right, so let them get on with it."
Because it must have been pretty straight-laced.
Yeah, probably they were. I mean, they had that sort of reputation, but like I say, they didn't get in our way at all. We had total freedom, and I could do whatever I wanted. And like I say, they didn't understand
why. And you had the same producer. What was his name?
Mike Vernon. Yeah, Mike Vernon, until I moved to America. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I got the Decca record contract expired, and then we went with Polydor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was for the next several albums, another chapter there.
It says in the book you were with Derham for a while.
Well, Derham was... It gets complicated, because I think that was the American version of some parts of Decca Records. You see, the first Decca albums got sold over here on the London Records label. And Derham, I think, was sort of part and parcel of the American company. So who knows?
Hmm. Yeah, that...
But the actual deal was with Decca, and then the next deal was with Polydor.
Yeah.
And then the next one was with ABC, so I only have that...
Did Mike Vernon go with you over to Polydor?
No.
Or was that strictly a Decca
thing?
No, he
was a staff producer.
Did you enjoy working with a producer? I noticed on your last one you produced it, but did you enjoy it during those years, or did you find it stifling, or did they
cut
you a lot of slack?
No, he was a friend of ours and a total supporter of the music and loved what we did. Mm-hmm. So he was just a friend, really. Mm-hmm. And the best producers are people who don't really get in the way. They're mm-hmm. just somebody who's in the booth there who can, wrap the engineer's fingers if he's getting the wrong idea. Because mm-hmm. that doesn't really happen anymore, because it was just in the early days where they didn't quite know what the music was supposed to sound like. Mm-hmm. Mike did, so
mm-hmm.
he was very helpful in that respect.
Now, he's been around a long time. In fact, he does a lot of stuff here in Hollywood now.
Oh, yeah. And he had Blue Horizon label, and he was the one who was instrumental, really, in getting Fleetwood Mac together and getting them started and did all their early recordings.
Yeah.
Wow.
So. Hmm. He also produced Blue by Nature, mm-hmm. Karen Lawrence.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I love that one that I love. He produced that?
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah,
that's a great album.
Yeah. She's a good singer.
She's fabulous.
So what are we going to hear next, John?
Well, the next thing logically is to go to the Turning Point album.
Okay.
But as an alternative to that, everybody's very familiar with the track from the Turning Point album called California. Just recently, we've unearthed some recordings that were done live at the Marquee the year before, or rather at the very beginning of the 69. And so it's interesting, you've got a different version of California, which is mainly an improvisational piece that people remember. John Mark is on acoustic guitar, I'm playing harmonica and guitar, and Johnny Armand is on saxophone and flute, and Steve Thompson on bass guitar. So this is from the Marquee, a live version of California.
All right.
Well, this one is a thing called California.
Take five.
That's all for now. Johnny Arnold, please.
From Padlock on the Blues, John Mayall's new album, Dancing Shoes. Dance with me, honey, crank it up loud and clear.
Little Dance and Shoes, written by Mr. John Mayall. John, that's a smoking track.
Yes, it's a very interesting transition from that heavily flower power cosmic man 60s thing up to the 80s, 90s, and on through. Yeah, that's Buddy Whittington on guitar, of course, in the been with the band 6 years now. John Paulus on bass guitar, and my veteran drummer Joey Whaley, who's just notched up 15 years. And the organ solo there was by our good friend Tommy Eyre, who joined up for the album on several of the tracks. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it was co-produced by my wife, Maggie Mayall, and myself, and it was all very much a...
Is Maggie a musician,
thing.
Too?
Yes, yeah, she's a singer. She met her over 20 years ago. She was the singer with Harvey Mandel's band at that time.
The Snake.
The mm-hmm. Snake.
The Snake.
The Snake.
Yeah. So,
I'm not familiar with that.
No, well, that was his nickname.
He
was in Canteen at one point. Oh. But Maggie has known my music for years and years.
How long have you been married, and how did you guys meet? On the road, or?
Yeah, you know? Actually, it's a gig where Harvey Mandel was playing at a festival in Stone Lake, Wisconsin in 1978. And I and my guitar player were guests of his band.
Mm-hmm.
So we met on stage virtually, and she hit me on the head with a tambourine. She was part of the general excitement, and we've been together ever since.
Uh-huh. What is that, Sophie Hawkins Day, when they hit you over the head with a tambourine?
I don't know.
Hawkins dances, didn't you guys have
that? I vaguely remember.
You're losing me now.
I never was invited to dances like that. I was always playing.
She had her own band a few years ago, Maggie Mayall and the Cadillacs, which was a great blues band, and... And now she takes a back seat. We're raising our family, and that takes a full-time job.
How many children?
Well, Maggie and I have six. He just turned 16. He's driving.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no. They want your insurance.
Three days ago, he passed his driving test.
Excellent.
And we have our little one, Sammy, who's going to be five in November. His birthday is the same day as mine, so we have a double there.
Excellent. Excellent. I wanted to ask you a question. You first came to do you remember the ballrooms and the Fillmore, the Grandy ballroom, the places in the late 60s that were happening? How did you feel about playing these places where you had so many people that were completely whacked out?
What you were going to say?
I was going to say, did you ever have any experience working with Will Graham, in, let's say, up in the Northern California?
Yeah.
As a promoter and stuff. And what was that whole scene like back then?
Well, for me, it was incredibly exciting because I'd always dreamed of going to America and never thought I would ever get there. But we went there for the first time. We did 2 weeks at the Café Agogo in New York in January 68. And from there... we went to do one gig at the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit, and then after that we went to the West Coast, and at that point, as soon as the plane landed, I realized that was home to me, and we played a week at the Whiskey A Go-Go in L.A., and then we did 2 weekends at the Fillmore with Bill Graham, his concerts, and that was in San Francisco, and the first show we did there was the famous... concert that is commemorated with the eyeball poster with Jimi Hendrix and Albert King, that one. So that was our first weekend there, so it was amazingly exciting. So you're talking about, you know, people who are whacked out and stoned, but really that wouldn't be the thing that we saw. You know, we saw a whole new audience of Americans who were just really into the music, and it was like they were discovering blues for the first time.
That was just wonderful to jam. I mean, so many bands, you could get up and play for 30, 40 minutes, and people just loved it.
Uh-huh. You know, our show was a little bit more disciplined than that. I mean, the numbers were of a reasonable length, and we did have our repertoire. It was mainly the repertoire being represented on the album Crusade, but of course we did stuff from the previous albums too. But... you know, there was a lot of jamming, but I think as a band leader, I was sort of against jamming because, you know, there has to be structure, I've always felt. You know, you have to have some kind of...
Well, you wouldn't call the turning point,
Point really had nowhere else to go except extensive improvisations all on one chord, you know, and it got very tired very quickly, really. That band was only together for a little less than a whole year. I mean, that was... and for the as much as people talk about it as a revolutionary type of thing, it was very limited ultimately, and there was, I think we only had about 7 or 8 tunes, and that was it.
But
they weren't necessarily long.
Yeah, the Grandy Ballroom. I remember the Grandy Ballroom. They used to roller skate while you played.
Yeah,
the home of the MC5 and Bob Seger, yeah, Ted Nugent. Yeah.
People roller skated while you were trying to sing.
It was a huge place.
It was an old roller rink.
Yeah.
And so they used to get in a really party mood and put on roller skates. And I remember them roller skating to The Who and forming this huge chain,
mm-hmm,
and whipping people all over the place. I mean, it was just amazing. It was a great time.
Where was I, and why don't they do that now? That sounds like...
It's a time that's gone, but yeah, it was a wonderful time. It really was great time for music.
Yeah,
this is the group on your new CD, Padlock on the Blues. This is the group you're going to take to Europe.
Yeah, like I say, we've been together for a long, long time.
And the organist as well will be going with you, or was
no?
Just
it's always just the four of us.
This nucleus:
bass, and drums, guitar, and my stuff.
And they've been together with you an average of 15 to...
Well, Joe's been with me for like 15 years, I can say, and Buddy 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
JP's been with me for 3.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's a long, long running outfit, and you know, that's what works best for us.
Mm-hmm.
So the four of us go over there, and we don't have roadies or tour managers or anything. We just do it all ourselves, and we're doing 50 shows in 52 days, and that will be throughout 12 different countries, I think. So we'll be home in time for Thanksgiving, but there are no days off.
You'll be playing Germany?
Yeah, we start off in Switzerland, and then from there we do probably about three and a half weeks in Germany, and a couple in France, thrown in the middle of that. And then we do a whole bunch in Scandinavia, and then we go to Hungary and... Czechoslovakia, Italy, Belgium, Holland. There's not too many places. Then we finish up in England for the last 3 shows. And we finish up in London, the last date. Then we come home.
How does it feel for you when you go back to England after you've been living here for so long?
Well, I have family there. You know, I have all my grandchildren there, and my other sons by my first marriage, and my mother and my sister. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's good to go home.
Friends, yeah. It's very interesting. It's a nice place, but I wouldn't like to live there.
Yeah, you know, right.
California has always been my home from the moment I landed.
Set foot on the soil.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, it's a hard road, isn't it, John?
Well, it can be, but you have to make the best of it, and as long as you enjoy the music, it all comes to life.
John, you've written some really remarkable tunes on this new album, and for the first time, I can really hear your voice.
Yeah.
I mean, I can really hear it's out front, and I love the mix.
Well, it's the same studio that we did the last album in, Blues for the Lost Days. It's the same engineer, and on the previous album we had John Porter as the producer, and you know, although he was very good, you know, it was still an outsider, in a sense. And this time around, of course, with Maggie being there, the one who would keep out of the way, but
who knows,
yeah, given valuable criticisms or suggestions here and there.
She knows what you're looking for.
It was her idea to grab John Lee Hooker as a guest, for instance.
Wow.
And I thought, wait a minute, he doesn't get guests on other people's albums. They do it on his, you know. So anyway, that, you know, it's a sort of example of how she was helping in the whole thing. So it was really when she co-wrote one of the songs, I've Got to Talk to You, which is on the album.
Wow.
Well, we have to play that.
And, yeah, certainly.
But let's play A Hard Road right now.
Absolutely.
All right.
Trying to tell you people that there's no
It's a Hard Road by Mr. John Mayall.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful cut, John.
Yeah, very powerful.
Yes, excellent. And the next piece we're going to play was written by your wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she wrote the lyrics, and I did the music, and a joint effort, I've Got to Talk to You.
And she was a blues singer.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Very much
did
so. Did she ever have a CD out?
No, they never recorded.
That's too bad.
Yeah. Well, the band that she had was an all-girl band. It was kind of special. Debbie Davies was the guitar player, and she went on her own.
Yeah.
And, that band was kind of magical and well-known along the California coastline and so forth, but when a person of that caliber leaves, Debbie left, and the saxophone player who was also the keyboard player, when she left, those people are basically irreplaceable, when you're getting an all-girl blues band together. So it kind of fizzled out, which was a great shame.
It is. Mm. It's too bad, but let's listen to this. I've Got to Talk to You.
I've got to talk to you. Gotta share the truth. I wanna talk to you. Let us get down to the root. I've gotta know you here, 'cause if we say it clear, at the end of the day, I'll be more and more in love with you. Talk to you, baby, let's get down. I wanna bear my soul. Respond and let me know you've heard.
John Mayall and John Lee Hooker, special guests, off the new album.
You tell me that you worry, feeling sick with an aching. Will you tell me that you worry, sick and tired with an aching? But come on over, baby, and lay down across my bed. Had a hard time sleeping, baby. So many bad dreams keep you awake. Had a hard time sleeping, baby. Toss and turn it wide awake. Well, I understand now, baby. Them old bad dreams are hard to take. She said that my bad dream captured, and the black night seems so long. She said I need your light beside me, help me through and make it strong. She said I need a man to hold me. Kept me through the night. She said, I need a man to hold me, being there to hold me tight. I'm a bad dream catcher, and I feel so full of fright. I said, I'll be your rising sun, baby, and I'll make you feel alright.
What did they say? That was Funky John?
That was Funky John.
That was Funky John.
It was Funky. Mr. John Lee Hooker and Mr. John Mayall together.
We certainly go back a long way.
That must have been fun to do, though.
Yeah. I mean, we've played together on the same concerts for many, many years. And like I said, in 1964, that's how long we've been together when he came over to England.
Yeah.
We accompanied him for a whole month.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, John, hate to say it, but it's time to go.
Yeah. Well, it's also another time. Listen, I haven't had my eye on the clock whatsoever, so it must have seems to have flown by smoothly.
We did enjoy it, and thank you so much for braving the freeways of Hollywood and Los Angeles.
And the hills here.
And the hills.
Yeah, the hills are trickier.
Enjoy it, and joining us on Blue Power.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for coming. And
please come back and visit us again sometime if you feel so inclined.
If I feel like reaching 5 million people, yes, I think I might.
Thank you so much, John. All right, Jeannie. Roll.
All right, John. It's time to say goodnight, everybody. And thanks for joining BluePower.com. I'm Jeannie C.
And I'm John R.
And we'll see you next time.
Thank you, Mr. Mayall.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
See you later.
Jeannie, I hate to say goodnight, but it's
Thank
that
you.
Time.
I can't even believe the time flew by on that last one.
Yeah, BluePower.com. It's been fortunate to have some wonderful people, and tonight we have Mr. John Mayall, the father of British blues. And, you know, we got Walter Trout coming up. We have Fito Della Parra coming up, the drummer from Canned Heat. He's going to talk about his book, Living the Blues. We have some wonderful people. And, Jeannie, you're absolutely beautiful. Thanks for hanging in here tonight.
It's amazing what makeup and a good microphone can do for a gal.
You're insane.
See you all later
baby.
On Cyberbill.
Love you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.